Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And now, prepare yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did ya? I say there ain't nobody. I say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow. Now is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast. With host A. Trunk.
What's up, everybody? It's Eddie Trunk, and welcome to another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. New every Thursday, wherever you get your podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. And as I tell you guys every week, the interviews you hear on this podcast all originated on my Sirius XM radio show, Trunk Nation, heard live Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 Eastern on Faction Talk, channel 103, or anytime on the Sirius XM app. If you are only listening to this podcast and you have Sirius XM or can get Sirius XM, which means you live in the US or Canada, you're only getting a tiny fraction of what I do live on the radio every day. Daily, I'm bringing you rock news, interviews, conversations, debates, all good stuff. Make sure you come on board and join us for the Daily Show. And hey, the holiday season is here. Maybe a good thing to ask for a Christmas gift. And if you want to sample SiriusXM, all you got to do is go to SiriusXM.com/Eddie Trunk. You can get 3 free months of the service, no credit card required. And you can listen to me each and every weekday on the app on demand or in the live window and hear the full picture of what we do covering the world of rock with 6 shows a week. Be sure to follow me on social media at Eddie Trunk, Twitter or X, Instagram and Facebook page for info and updates. I'm a little over a week away from celebrating my 40th year in broadcasting. Big event going down December 11th at the House of Blues in Vegas. Sammy Hagar, Michael Anthony headlining the show. It's going to be great. I'll keep you updated on the radio show and on social media, and I'll let you know if we're able to release any more tickets as we get a little bit closer. All right, this week on the podcast, 2 interviews for you. Coming up second, Joey Tempest, lead singer of the band Europe. Joey checked in from his home in England, and he talked about, he was on the road when he called in, somewhere in Europe. Europe in Europe, makes sense. But he talked about a brand new Europe song that's just come out, a coming documentary, and a coming new album. So Joey Tempest, lead singer of the Swedish band Europe, coming up, of course, best known for the Final Countdown. That's coming up a little bit later on in the podcast. But we lead this week with Rick Emmett from Triumph. Rick recently released an autobiography, talked a little bit about Triumph's history, if there's a future for the band, and some great, funny, revealing stories from his current book, which has just come out. So we'll talk to Rick first, Joey Tempest, an international Eddie Trunk podcast, Canada to start, Sweden to follow. We'll start with Rick Emmett right now. Enjoy. How are you, Rick?
Edward Trunk Esquire. I'm doing excellent. How are you?
I wish I was an Esquire. I'd be making a lot more money.
Yeah, no, I'm doing good. I'm doing the rounds of interviews now. So, you know, my throat might give out at any moment, but I'm doing good.
Well, fortunately, you just gotta talk and not sing when you do the interviews. As long as you don't have a gigs lined up, you should be okay.
Yeah, no gigs lined up. Although I am going to Sweden for New Year's.
Is that right? To play a gig or to vacation?
It's a kind of a long story, but I'll try to tell it short. I have some friends that play in a band that goes and plays the Junior World Hockey Championships, wherever they might be. And so this year they're in Gothenburg, Sweden. And so the Canadian contingent, they go on over there and you know, it's like the moms and it's a junior hockey. So it's the moms and the dads and the girlfriends and the brothers and the sisters, you know, like families go and support them. And the Canadian contingent in the stands at these games is always sizable and crazy. So for New Year's, they always throw a big party and they get a band to play. And they like to do Canadian classic rock kind of stuff. And so I have a couple of friends that have been in the band in past years, and they said, come on, Rick, you got to come. And I went, oh, I don't think so. And they said, no, Rick, we're going to do some Triumph songs this year. You got to come. Anyways, long story short, I'm going. They're going to have a string quartet and some horn players. And I went, well, I've never heard, you know, Hold On and Lay It on the Line and Magic Power with strings and horns before. So that sounds like it'll be fun. All right, I'm coming.
Is it a challenge for you at this age, at this point in your life, to sing the old Triumph songs?
Oh, yeah, of course, yes. And in fact, like, for example, Magic Power was originally in the key of D, and it sounds pretty good in that key. It's a very guitar-friendly kind of key and stuff, open guitar strings, all of those sorts of things. But I redid it in the key of A, so I dropped it down like a whole, either a fourth or a fifth, depending on which way you're looking at it. But when it's in A, you can really kind of give it the Pete Townsend beat the crap out of the guitar treatment. So it's kind of fun to do it that way. And I went, okay, I'll do it that way. Now, Lay It, I kind of had to do a little bit of the, you remember when Eric Clapton redid Layla and turned it from
yes.
the, you know, screaming rock version into the very laid back swung kind of bluesy thing. I didn't go quite that far, but I kind of gave it the same treatment and dropped some of the melodies down a bit and made it a little easier to handle. So, yeah, I mean, you know, Hold On, there's really no way around it. You got to do it in the original key. But I don't know if you ever saw Queen. You're maybe too young for this, but you know, I saw Queen live a few times when they were touring back in the day. And Freddie would often sing melodies. He would transpose them and move them down. He wouldn't sing them in the original recorded, you know, keys. Because, you know, after you've done three nights in a row, like, there's just no way you can hit the high notes anymore. So you got to start becoming creative, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, I didn't know. I only saw Queen once with Freddie. It was on the last tour, but I did on Hot Space. But I didn't know, I mean, him being the singer that he was, I didn't even know he had to do that at some point. But obviously it's the norm now for a lot of acts that tour that the singers get a bit older. And the reason why I brought that up to you is because, and we're going to get into your book here in a second, but one of the things that I had gotten a call about maybe a year or so less ago was that the producer, Mike Klink, got in touch with me and told me he was working on a Triumph tribute record. And he told me that he couldn't find name singers that could sing your stuff. He was the stuff that Gil sang, he could find singers for because it wasn't so high, but he said he couldn't find like enough people that would sing, go after your songs and be able to sing in that key, original key on those songs.
Yeah, no, it's true. And when I talked to Mike, I said, well, you're going to have to find females, you know, that might be part of your solution. And the other side of it is, you know, they're kind of looking for people that have made a name for themselves. But the world of rock, I mean, it kind of changed, you know, after the Triumph era, the era came in with grunge and Nirvana and you know, Eddie Vedder and Creed. And so all of the singers, it became this, you know, much darker, kind of heavier kind of sound, you know. And so you didn't get a new generation of guys that sang up there with, you know, me, Getty, Robert Plant, John Anderson, you know. And I can remember, we once, 83, we were out doing some stadium shows, and Journey was the headliner. And it's like Steve Perry even came to me and said, man, are you hitting high Bs in that song? Are you hitting a high D and a high E? And I'm going, oh, yeah, every night. He's going like, you're out of your mind. But, of course, I remember, you know, when I was a kid, I would go to see Deep Purple concerts and Ian Gillan, and they would do like Child in Time, and he would be hitting high A's. And I'm talking about, you know, the note that sits at the 17th fret of the E string of a guitar, and Ian Gillan would be doing this screaming head tone kind of thing, hitting these, and they were high A's. And I go, okay, well, you know, we don't really have a world like that anymore, but there's some metal guys that could do it. Maybe they were just going like, yeah, I don't want to.
Yeah, but you know, I always wonder about this too, Rick, with that kind of stuff. And I've asked singers this, like, okay, so back in 81 or whatever, you're singing Magic Power and you're much younger and you're doing that and it's, you know, it's kind of comfortable for you or whatever. But in the back of your mind, are you saying to yourself, damn, if this thing becomes a hit in 40 years, I'm painting myself into a corner having to do it?
No, come on now, bud. You're talking about rock stars. Rock stars don't sit around thinking about things 40 years from now, you know.
Like, right.
Yeah, like you're living in the moment. And,
right.
And there's another part of you, of course, which is that egotistical kind of, you know, the testosterone of youth. You're going to live forever. You know, you're going to be able to do this forever. I can do this now. Why wouldn't I be able to do this forever? You know, so, you know, you don't really, you know, people have warned you about growing old and you're not paying any attention.
Right. It's very true. So let's talk about your book, Lay It on the Line. It's out. I'm assuming it's out now, right? Is it available everywhere now?
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, they can get it at Amazon or they can get it at their local bookstore or, you know, it's on ECW Press. So, you know, there's probably, I don't know, 1,000 ways you can order it online one way or another. But yeah, the book is out. Yes.
So I enjoyed it. I have it. I was on a plane over the weekend. I had a chance to get into most of it. And the first thing that struck me about it, Rick, was it's the format of it and the way you did it is a bit different than your traditional autobiography. When I was telling my audience about you coming on, I called the book an autobiography, but I said, but it's a bit different because the way you pace it, the formatting of it, and there's almost elements of it where it almost becomes like, you know, if you want to be a musician or you want to know about this, where it's almost an advice book at some point where it's like your experiences, but relate in a different way. So tell me about your approach to doing this versus the, you know, the traditional format of an autobiography.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, first of all, I felt very strongly that I really only wanted to do this once. So, you know, if I'm going to do more writing, and I love writing, and I think I've written a book of poetry before this, I would hope that I might have a few more of those in me. I might even have a novel in me at some point. I'm not sure. But, of course, I always want to keep songwriting and doing that. So I will continue writing and being creative. When you decide you're going to do, you know, autobiography or biography or memoir, you know, you're going back into the past and you're bringing up the things from your life. And so I'm not really a backwards looking kind of creative person. I like to be moving forward. I like to be in this moment and be looking at the horizon going, hey, I wonder what's up there. So that stuff, as I approached the book, I was thinking, okay, well, you know, here's an example, the Triumph chapter, which is called the Triumph chapter. It's only one chapter in about 16. And as you described, there's ones that talk about being in the music business. There's ones that talk about playing guitar and how much that means to me. And those things are like being a family man, being a dad, being a husband. All of those things meant more to me than being a rock star. And so they end up, and of course I taught college for 20 years, you know, like my life was one where the early part of my week was about going into the college and teaching a few days. And then the weekends were like, okay, climb on a plane, fly out, go play some gigs, you know, come back home, repeat, ad infinitum. So, you know, that idea of teaching, it's always kind of been a part of me. And as I was putting the book together, I was thinking, well, you know, there was one time where I wrote an article for, I wrote for Guitar Player magazine for, you know, 19 years. I can't remember how long, 13 years, something like that. I was in the band for 13. I think I wrote for the magazine for 14 or 15. I can't remember exactly. Anyhow, but I wrote an article for a retailer, music retailer here in Canada that was in their sort of yearly catalog. And it was like my top 10 hits for trying to teach musicians. If you want to have a career in the music business, this is what. And so I'd already distilled that knowledge down into a magazine article. I went, well, this should be included in some kind of chapter that's about that kind of thing, because I don't want the memoir to just be something that only has a value of. And believe me, I read a lot of memoirs and did research and stuff, and I hate the ones where the guy essentially takes his day book and goes, you know, on Tuesday we were in Ohio, and then on Wednesday we climbed on the bus, and you go, yeah, I don't really care. It doesn't have much value to me. It doesn't really have a lot of weight, you know. So I was looking for things that might have a little more meat on the bone, you know.
Yeah, well, no doubt, and I think it's going to be really for Triumph fans enjoy reading it, but just even if you're not the hugest Triumph fan, just your story and also people that maybe are aspiring musicians to learn the story a little bit and learn of your experiences and how varied they are. And, you know, one of the things I kind of took from this, Rick, is like as you laid out you getting into Triumph and how Gil and Mike came to see you and all of that, and they had already had something cooking. And then it seems like, because you say in the book, you were never in it for the sex and drug stuff. You were in it for the music. But tell me if I got this wrong, but it almost felt like you got into Triumph. The band took off to some degree, but it really, you never really felt like you were going to be in it for the long haul. You're almost kind of reluctantly in it for as long as you were. Do I have that right?
Well, I mean, obviously in the early days, there was no reluctance. I was, you know, jumped in with both feet and both arms and, you know, a big fat head. And I was in there. And I think the story of that is that in the early days, the band was Three Musketeers, you know, All for One, One for All. And it really felt like that's what we were doing. And then after it had success and started to climb, I do think that there were things like the very things that gave the band strengths, which was that I was kind of this creative writer, singer, guitar player kind of guy. The drummer Gil was really smart and really good at general management of the band, the booking agency end of things, the live stage production end of things, that side of what the music business is like. And Mike was really good at radio and really good at marketing and promotion, and he was a pretty good sales guy, you know. So that kind of stuff made it so that we were kind of covering all the fronts. We didn't really need a manager, and we didn't. After making the record deals, we were self-managed, and it was really the other guys that did most of the business, and I would be in the studio working on my own. And so these were the strengths as the band developed. But then as successes started to happen, you know, and it was like, oh, Rick wrote these songs, and now Rick is getting played on the radio, and but Rick's videos get played on MTV, and I'm in some ways, I think it's probably the same thing that happens when, I don't know, in much larger kinds of circumstances, you've got, say, the Police, and you've got Sting, and it's looking like, well, the guy could write his own ticket if he wanted to, and then eventually he decides, I think I will. Like, you know, I'm tired of having fistfights with Stewart backstage, you know, from time to time. Even look at the Beatles, the biggest band of all time. And I think there was a resentment from Lennon that was like, oh, you know, Paul gets all the girls screaming for him, and Paul gets the songs that go to number one for 10 weeks. And, you know, I'm always getting put on the B-sides. And my songs deserve as much notoriety, as much focus as his, you know, I'm going to go and have my own life. And George Harrison felt the same way, too. And, you know, I just think that's the story of bands in general. That's kind of what happens over time. So the very things that bring you success are also the things that start driving wedges into what's going on, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and you talk about that in the book, that that kind of became a problem where there were two lead singers in Triumph, Gil, the drummer, and yourself, but you're the guy out front. You're the guy that's also playing guitar, and you're the guy whose songs and the ones that you sing were getting the bulk of the radio and the bulk of the success. So that led to, I mean, you actually told the story in the book, I think, I don't know if it was Ron Nevison or one of the producers that had gotten involved in you with you guys and took a song and gave it to you that originally I think Gil was going to sing, and that caused a bit of a problem. And, you know, I had heard, again, you're right, it's not an uncommon story. I remember, I think there was animosity with Heart because the one number one song that they had, Nancy sang, not Anne. And that was always a thing. So that kind of stuff is there. And you dealt with it, it seemed like, throughout much of the time in there. Was that one of the bigger, because you said a couple of times in the book when it came to Triumph that before you actually did leave the band, you had thought about doing it much earlier and you were almost kind of staying in there a bit reluctantly. So was that the biggest issue? I mean, I know that there was also this big, you owed the label $3 million. There was some business stuff that didn't go right as well.
Yeah. So that word reluctance, you know, you've raised it again. And I think what happened is we got to about 84, like 83, we were trying to get away from RCA. We moved to MCA, and that created the huge, you know, unrecouped debt. I'd been left to my own devices making the Thunder 7 album in the studio. And so there was a lot on that album that was complete fun for me, like the making of the Time Cannon, which is, 55 tracks of lead vocals. And I had guitar piece. Midsummer Daydream was on that album. And there was a blues thing, Little Boy Blues. So I was on my own, and I was getting to do these things. They were all kind of like B cuts or C cuts, but I was always the kind of guy that was of a mind that I liked albums because I kind of liked B cuts, and I liked things that were off the beaten path, not the hits that were going to be the beaten path. And the record business was slowly but surely, and radio too, was turning into a beaten path kind of a thing where you put on an album, and there had to be, you know, Def Leppard would have 7 songs of the 10 that could all be singles, or Bryan Adams would have 10 out of 10 that could all be, you know. So, and those things would become huge hits. That, like, that was the Nevison thing you mentioned, the Heart album. You know, like, I don't know. The year that the record company was deciding, hey, Nevison would be a great guy for the Triumph thing, was because Nevison had done the trick with Starship and done it with Heart, where they weren't even songs that were necessarily written by the band. They were written by outside writers. Nevison would bring them to the band. He would do these kinds of arrangements and productions that radio would love. And then you'd have your big hits like We Built the City and These Dreams and What About Love, you know, the huge hits. I think they sold like 5 million albums of that Heart thing in, you know, one quarter, you know, or one half of a year. And so that was what the industry was turning into. And I really, you know, you talk about reluctance. I was kind of reluctant to be in that kind of a band, in that kind of a world, chasing that kind of a thing. I was a guy that had put Suitcase Blues on the Just a Game album. And that's more kind of the story of a big part of my career than, you know, the writing of Somebody's Out There, which I did kind of overnight because the record company went, hey, we need a hit. We need a lead single. Can you write a lead single? I went, yeah, okay, I can write a lead single. Yeah, here, you know, Somebody's Out There. And it was the highest charting song Triumph ever had on Billboard. But, it, you know, was my heart in it? Yes, but, you know, not all of my heart because, you know, I wanted to be an artist. You know, you sign a deal in it. The bottom line calls you a recording artist, and that's kind of what I wanted to be. I didn't want to necessarily be a pop star, never mind a rock star, you know, and that was kind of what the business was turning into.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that struck me about the Triumph years, and then I want to hit you with a couple other things here, but the other thing that struck me about that, and it's something that I always felt too. So I think Triumph's level of success, and you'd probably agree with this, at least here in America, was different market by market, because back in those days, independent radio stations existed, and you could have people that were champions in one market, and they'd drive the band a lot more, like for you guys, Texas, in certain areas, and other areas where you didn't get radio. Now it's all consolidated. Everybody pretty much plays the same thing, but it wasn't like that back then. But you make the case, like with Triumph, it's pretty interesting because the band certainly got big, and the band certainly got popular, certainly in certain pockets, for sure. But you never, the band, as for as popular as it got, never went to that next mega level. And you reference that in the book, and you bring that up. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts as to why that is, why you didn't go to the, you know, you got close, but you just never got over that next hump to the huge level of some of the other bands of that time.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons for it. You know, not the least of which was that the band did have a kind of a schizoid thing that it was trying to be because of two singers. Whereas the bands that did do that, and, you know, Journey would be a good example, you know, every record sounded, you go, yeah, that's Steve Perry, you know. And I mean, if you think about it too, Journey was the kind of band where they had really highly skilled guys in the band that had a really good understanding of, okay, you know, our bed tracks, we got to get, like, Steve Smith's got to, we got to get him as a drummer here. And they would replace members until they finally got to the point where they go, okay, this is the kind of stainless steel, chromium spine version of the band now that the from a commercial point of view, it can't be denied. And the world was heading to that, you know, Mutt Lange was turning the trick for Bryan Adams, turning the trick for AC/DC, turning the trick for Def Leppard, eventually for Shania Twain. Like, that guy had an understanding of, no, this is how the industry works. This is how radio works. This is what the public now wants. And it's not all the public, but enough of it that it's going to turn that trick of, you know, 5x platinum, 7x platinum, it's going to find a mass market, you know. And in later years, there were bands like Nickelback that understood that and was able to do that. And as you say, we have this consolidation now where, you know, if you get that Clear Channel thing, hey, you're rocking, you know. They don't even call it Clear Channel anymore, but, you know, that's the idea. There's this consolidation of playlisting so that you're going to get that. So that was already starting to happen, and Triumph was not really the kind of band that sat comfortably in that. I think the other thing, too, which requires, you know, mentioning is that the band was we would play live, and that would be something people would come and see it and go, what a show. Like, whoa, what? I'm a Triumph fan now, man. Like, I'm never going to miss them when they come to town. They're great. So we were good at selling concert tickets in places where we built it up, you know, and you kind of needed airplay and concerts at the same time in order to make a market happen like that. But there were some places, as you said, we never got any airplay, so we never went there. We went and toured England and Scotland once, and then I think it was like 80, 81, and we never went back. We went like, pfft, you know, wow, that was hard, and small things, and people didn't really get what we're about. You know, we'd much rather go to San Diego in the wintertime, you know. So we would only ever tour the United States and Canada, and we wouldn't really break other markets. Whereas, you know, this large-scale thing you're talking about, you know, I mean, I was just reading the thing about McCartney going to Australia and doing a tour, and I'm going, oh, yeah. Like, Dave Grohl seems to have, like, just a bottomless ambition and energy so that he tours Asia and Australia, and he goes out with other bands, and he's, like, he's just constantly working. And in my band, we had guys that, you know, like, I wanted to be at home with my kids. I wanted to I wanted to go to parents' night. You know, I wanted to coach my kids playing, you know, neighborhood sports. Gil wanted to play golf. You know, Mike liked to go to Jamaica in the winters. So we weren't so consumed with the idea of we must keep driving this machine. You know, this rock and roll machine must be driven until we've sold 10 million records.
Right. Yeah, no, that definitely sounds, you know, about right from my takeaway from the book as well. And yeah, there's something to be said for that because you successfully held your family together and your marriage together, you know, for many, many decades. And you probably wouldn't have been able to do that if you were, you know, hitting it as hard as some of these other people out there were doing. And I know that you said right from the get-go, that was something that was really important for you. Where would you say, Rick, closing out on Triumph, and then I'm going to hit you with another couple quick things here, but as far as Triumph was concerned, where would you say for you personally was the, you know, the peak for you in terms of the, you know, the best moment, the best record where you were happiest? Would you say it was around Allied Forces?
Certainly that was one of my favorite albums and the making of it. I mean, we built the studio, Metalworks, and then we were in there. And the world was our oyster. You know, it was like I loved that experience. The band writing, the pre-production, the making of the record, the way the record ended up sounding, the songs we had on there. I was feeling like, yeah, the band has really come into its own. We've discovered what this band really and truly can be. You know, but the fallout of it, of course, was that after that one, and then for Surrender, RCA was kind of going, yeah, we would like this band to be, you know, Rick out front and Rick singing all the songs. And Gil and Mike, they were not happy about that. They wanted out. You know, they wanted to get away from RCA because they did want to chase a much bigger thing. And RCA was going, look, we got you locked in. You know, you're just only going to get the recording budgets that you get. And we think you're going to be sort of like a Blue Oyster Cultish kind of band. We don't think you're going to turn the Journey trick or the Styx trick or whatever, you know. So that was a big, there was a strong rub there. But Allied, yeah, that you know, it, creatively it was a really nice moment. Then the tour we did in 83 where we, I played big outdoor shows. I got jammed on stage with Sammy Hager and Ted Nugent, and we did those Journey shows and big stadiums, you know. We did the US Festival on the Memorial Day weekend of that. The night before we played the US Festival, by the way, we had played in Florida up the bill from a ZZ Top thing so that summer was just full of these, you know, crazy great stadium shows. And the thing I loved about that, and which became a kind of a like a hallmark of Triumph, was that we played the US Festival in the afternoon. There was no lights. There was no flamethrowers. There was no flash pots. We just got up and played our tunes for an hour. And that became a kind of a legacy thing for Triumph. And I went, see, guys, we could have just been a rock band. You know, like, we could have just got up there and just been musicians and played our stuff. We didn't need all of the bells and whistles. But, you know, I think for the other guys, they really felt like, no, it's not Triumph unless it's got the bells and whistles, you know. Now, so I would say, and I mentioned earlier, your question is about highlights, you know, but being left in the studio for the guys were out trying to find a new record deal and going around, and they'd been through the whole legal battle with RCA, and so I'd been left to my own devices for a long time, and so the making of Thunder 7 was kind of one where I went, hey, you know, as a recording artist, you can really take advantage of the studio as this, you know. And I mean, I think every artist that has a record deal does arrive at that point at some juncture in their career. But that was around 86 for me, you know. And then, you know, 87, 88, I could have done without it. You know, that wasn't as much fun. There's really no highlights from there. So,
yeah, yeah. You know what I was interested in the book too, when you left Triumph, of course they continued for a brief time and did another record and brought Phil X in to replace you briefly. But the thing that I thought was interesting is that you were approached about some other potential gigs and joining up with some other things. One of those was possibly joining the band Boston, and also being approached about possibly being a part of the Damn Yankees. What can you tell the audience about those two approaches and what your thoughts were about them at the time? Obviously, you didn't end up doing either.
No. And there were actually three. You left out the Asia one, but yeah.
Asia, like the, right, yeah.
Yeah, the Boston one came first, if my recollection serves. And it was just like I got a call, and the guy said, hey, you know, Tom would be interested in maybe having you join the band. And I went, whoa. And it was like, he wants you to come down and be in the studio, and he wants to, you know, just bounce some things off you. And I'm thinking, oh, he wants to co-write. He really wants to have somebody into the band. That sounds awesome. And I flew down, and I had a great time with Tom and enjoyed my day in the studio with him. And we went out for dinner. And then a couple of days later, I got a call from the guy, and he goes, well, congratulations, you've got the job. You know, they want you to sing and play guitar in the touring band for the summer. And I went, wait, what? I thought you were making an album. He goes, oh, no, the album's finished, really. Because what I'd done was sort of sing parts on, you know, multi-track tape in his basement studio, the famous, you know, Tom Scholz basement studio. I was flattered that, that they were offering, but I didn't want to step from being in one rock band to just being in somebody else's rock band again and kind of just being a sideman, you know, getting hired to go out for the summer. And I went, oh, no, I pass. You know, I'd rather be doing my own sort of humble little thing. And I think from a profile point of view, it probably would have been good for me. It might have been good for Tom, you know, and the whole Boston, I don't know what you'd call it, franchise that he owns and runs, you know. And then the other one, it's kind of the same story, where I got a call early, and it was because my name had been out there. I think the first album I had made for the America was Charisma Records, the Absolutely album. And then Charisma, the record came out, and they went bankrupt. And so literally it was like overnight that record just started, you know, swirling down the toilet. And then I think everybody that was sort of in the business, and in particular John Kolodner at Geffen, I think John went, hey, that guy's a free agent again. So I think the conversation had maybe been Bud Prager was managing Ted, and maybe he even knew something about, I don't know, Tommy or whatever. I got a call from, I think it was Jack Blades, and he kind of pitched me about this thing that they were doing. And I went, well, Jack, and I think I'd met Jack, you know, back in the day, Night Ranger, and we'd been on the bill on some of these big summer outdoor show things out on the West Coast. So I'd met all the guys, and I like Jack. He's you know, tremendous energy, really cool guy, you know, great singer, really good stage personality kind of dude. And so anyways, he pitched me, and I went, hey, well, who you got? And he goes, well, I got Tommy Shaw and Ted Nugent. And I went, Jack, you already got more guitar than you're ever going to need. If you're in a band with Ted Nugent, I don't know how you're going to find any wiggle room there. You know, especially for a guy like me. You know, I'm the kind of guy where, plus, I mean, they ended up calling the Damn Yankees, and I'm just a Canuck, you know. So but what are they going to do, have a crazy Canuck in with the Damn Yankees? I don't think that's going to fly, you know. So I passed on that one. And the Asia thing, similar story. Wetton and Carl Palmer called me at different times, and it was because they were going to go out. They had a greatest hits album coming out, and they were going to have some big outdoor shows. And I think the guy that had played with them on the last couple of tours was Pat Thrall or somebody of that nature. But he wasn't available, so they were looking for somebody. And so, you know, these fellas with, you know, very proper British accents, you know, and they're giving me a call in the. And I went, guys, you know, I'm not looking to be a sideman in somebody's band. You know, thank you. I'm honored that you ask. But right. that ain't my thing.
Last thing, there is a funny story in the book about your most humbling gig, which basically equates to you playing in a grocery store. Can you... can we close on you telling my audience that story? Because I thought that was funny.
Yeah. The greatest gigs of all time. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, over the years I'd always had endorsement deals with guitar companies and you know, I'm not going to name any names here, but, I would from time to time go out and do little mini tour things where I would be, you know, they'd have a new product line of stuff out and, you know, they want me to go out and be playing on some new guitars or whatever. So I was in Kingston, Ontario, and it would often be in these circumstances, the guy that runs the local music store would decide, oh, yeah, Rick Emmett, come in, do a guitar seminar. That'd be fantastic. But the guy, it was summertime, and he'd bought so much product for his big sale that he was going to have in conjunction with his, you know, I don't know, weekend of seminars or whatever he was doing. The store was filled up with boxes and boxes of stuff, and so they couldn't really do it in store, but it was summertime. He goes, that's okay. We're going to have a nice big stage across the street in the parking lot of the, you know, Grosseteria, the giant, you know, big box grocery store. And it was a nice stage. When I got there, it was a nice stage. I could see it had like a roof over it, and they had a big PA set up and everything, and everyone chairs. But it was absolutely pissing rain. It was like a complete tornado kind of day. And I'm going, well, that ain't going to happen. And the guy goes, no, don't worry. We've got, you know, plan C. There's a coffee shop in the grocery store up on the mezzanine level, and we've got a little PA set up there, and so you can we'll do it in there. And I'm going, well, okay. And so I go in and climb the stairs. Now, there's no one there. Like there's very few people in the grocery store on this, I don't know, Friday or Saturday night, whatever. I think it was probably a Saturday, because there was this incredible storm, and there was like hail. So, and it had a metal roof, so you could hear the hail banging off this metal roof only about, you know, 10 feet above my head when I was up at the mezzanine level. And I'm sitting there now and, you know, tuning my guitar and getting ready to do this. There's only the guy from the music store, the guy running the PA, the girl in the hairnet that sells the coffee and the donuts. And, you know, if I turned around and looked over the railing at my back, I could look right down into the produce section and I could see the ladies squeezing the Jaffa oranges. You know, like, I'm not kidding. It was like, and meanwhile, I'm going to start playing, and there's all this thing where it's like, the Muzak is still going in the store, and then every now and then, you know, it's like, a car, clean up on aisle six, clean up on aisle six. And I'm going like, okay, could we get them to turn off their main PA just when I'm going to do my thing, you know? And it was very, very humbling, you know.
Total Spinal Tap. Sounds total
Spinal Tap. Oh, man, it was just, you know. Anyhow. And then, after it was over, I had to get in my car and drive home in this monsoon, you know, like for 3 hours in the car going, well, that was something, wasn't it?
That was, you think
that
about
was
it.
Really, really something.
Ponder
yeah.
It.
Okay.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is just a few of the things you can read about. I don't want to give it all away, but there's great stuff in Rick's book. Again, it's Laid on the Line, A Backstage Pass to Rockstar Adventure, Conflict and Triumph, Rick Emmett's book. It's out there now, as you just heard him say. And Rick, just in closing, what can you Triumph as a band? I mean, I know that the documentary came out and all of that, but the idea of ever playing together again is pretty much a dead issue, right? I mean, we're not going to see Triumph again live, right?
I doubt it, you know. And I mean, the problem with, you know, you should never say never. And that sometimes things pop up where it becomes too delicious to say no. Like, you know, me going to Sweden to play for New Year's, you know, like these things do happen. But there was recently a Walk of Fame event that occurred here in Toronto. And, you know, I got a really lovely invitation. Did I want to come and sing a Rush song? Kim Mitchell was getting inducted, and they were going to do the song Battle Scar that, you know, Getty had sung. And there'd been like two bass guitars and two drummers. And they said, you know, would you want to come in and sing the Getty Lee part? And, oh, man, I was sorely tempted, you know. But then I sat down and I listened to the song again after all these years, and I went, yeah, I'm not doing that. You know, I don't think I can cut that anymore. So you're probably right. It's probably, you know, a dead issue, but, you know, you never really want to say die, right? You always want to kind of keep the flame flickering.
Did you get offers? Did you guys get offers off of the documentary coming out a few years ago that there was interest, or some people knock on your door off of that?
I'm sure there were, and I'm sure that the other guys get them. Like, I don't really get them because I'm not really part of it. You know, like, the Triumph thing is it's Gills. And I think Mike has kind of been struggling health-wise lately. And so I think he's even sort of out of the picture. I was over at Metalworks at the studio last week shooting some video because the pickup company that I work for, or MJS that I have a deal with, they wanted to shoot some stuff that they can use for, you know, things on their website and videos from YouTube. And it just so happens that I've been working up my own jazz guitar pieces on a Telecaster guitar that they'd custom made with their pickups in it. And I went, yeah, I'll bring that. Like, that sounds great. And so I played a little excerpt from this thing called 10 Telecaster Tales, which is, you know, the next album I'm going to make. And I've been working on the pieces and stuff. So I was there and I got to set with Gil and we talked, and I hadn't seen him for a long time, and it was great. We were able to catch up, but you know, I mean, we don't really talk too much about Triumph. I don't think too much of that business. Gil is the kind of guy that he's always got 14 fires going, and his fingers are in all of them. And I don't know how he does that if he only has 10 fingers, but never mind. Anyhow, he's got his fingers in a lot of pies that are cooking on a lot of fires. How's that?
Right. And is Mike okay? I mean, not to get into his business, but you said he's got some health stuff. Is he okay?
You know, you reach a certain age, Eddie, and you know, things start, you know, wearing out. I have my own problems, you know, but
well, yeah,
in
I know.
Mike's case, I think it was more that just bronchial stuff, and it was like a lingering cold that he was having a hard time getting rid of. So I talked to him on the phone, and you know, he wouldn't sound 100%. So it's hard for me to imagine him sitting in a meeting and somebody going, yeah, so we would like you to come and do, you know, a dozen shows in the Far East. And Mike going, yeah, I'm up for that. Like Mike
right,
going,
right.
I don't think so.
Right. Yeah. And I got you. Yeah. Well, listen, man, it's always great to talk to you. And I'm glad to hear that you're well. And congratulations on the book. Everybody check it out. It's out there now. And you got music coming as well. You got more stuff coming on your own?
Yeah, that 10 Telecaster Tales. You know, I haven't got the masters completed yet, but I've been, you know, starting the project, and I've got everything's written. It takes a little bit longer for me to get things under my hands now than it used to, but that one's on the way, and I've written some tunes. I've also got a package coming out in a bit called Diamonds, which is a repackaging of the stuff that I did after I left Triumph. I had three albums for an indie label called Duke Street, and I got those masters back. And so I kind of went around, and I have some friends that are, you know, in the business of putting out vinyl things, et cetera, et cetera. So a company called Merch in Motion, which is Rock Paper Merch Online, they're doing a thing where this package is coming out. It's sort of the harder rock tracks, some of the demos that are going to be like bonus tracks on it. And that's coming out in a couple of weeks, I think. So, yeah, that's called Diamonds. And yeah, and so, you know, I keep busy. The stuff keeps resurfacing from time to time. There's another project I got going where I wrote two songs with a guy named Don Brightup. He's got a band called Monkey House, and it's a very jazzy, bluesy, Steely Danish kind of vibe. And so I might take some of the old tracks and repackage them and put them with some of the stuff that I've been writing with Don, but we'll see. That might be a year or a year and a half away. Who knows?
Well, sounds like you got a lot of good stuff cooking, and it's always great to visit with you, Rick. Best to the family, and hopefully I get a chance to see you soon. Everybody pick up Rick's book, Lay It on the Line, out there right now. Thanks for the
time,
man.
That's great.
Good talking to you.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, thanks to Rick Emmett. Check out his book. It's out now, and always great to visit with him, and always appreciate him coming on the show and being so candid and honest about the past and the future with his band, Triumph.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
Price drop? Time to shop. Get to a Nordstrom Rack store today for first dibs on new markdowns. Now score even more, up to 70% off brands everyone loves at Nordstrom Rack. Denim, dresses, sneakers, tops, and more. Plus, get genius deals on jackets, sweaters, and boots for the whole family. Shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and save up to 70% with new markdowns. But hurry, deals this great won't last.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Promised you a second interview this week, and I'll bring it to you right now. Joey Tempest, lead singer of the band Europe. Here's an update from him on the Eddie Trunk podcast. Joey, how are you, bud?
I'm good, Eddie. Good to talk to you again.
You too, man. It's been a little bit, and congratulations on 40 years of Europe. I mean, a tremendous accomplishment, which I'm sure when you were starting the band out, you had no idea that in 2023 you'd be making new music and touring and still going, right?
No, that's the case, isn't it? You're young and you're bulletproof there for a few years. You think maybe a year ahead, but you never dream that you'd be like you. These other bands that you've seen being around a long time. But here we are, and we are the same guys. We met when we were teenagers, and we're so lucky to be touring and doing a 40th anniversary tour, and it's quite amazing.
You know, I'm curious about that, actually, because, of course, I know the band, and I'm a fan of the band, but I don't know the deep, deep history from way back when. The lineup you have now that's going out and playing 40 years, is it all the same guys that you started with? There are one or two variations there if you get technical.
Yeah, if you get technical, yeah. We started in 83, and we were a four-piece, and we had Tony Reno on drums on the first album and the second album. So Mick Michaeli and Ian Howland, the drummer and the keyboard player, came in about 84, 85. So they are, yeah, they're 40 years in the band. So, but this is the lineup that went on the Wings of Tomorrow tour and that went on went on to record the Final Countdown album. And from then on, and then John Norum left for a few albums, but he's been back longer than he's been, you know, the first time. So it's the same brothers now.
Yeah, no, there was that period with Key Marcello, I know, on guitar, and then John came back. But it's amazing, man. It's true, because that, as you know, and, you know, we've talked, I mean, you and I are very much into a lot of the same music that we grew up with and stuff. And it's incredible because there's so few bands that, beyond those little changes, as you mentioned, that happened over the 40 years plus, there's so few bands that hold together a lineup like you guys have. What do you attribute that to, Joey?
Well, it's a little bit of that thing. We went to see shows together. I think that cemented. We are from the same neighborhood. So me, John, and John, we met when we were like, we're talking 13, 14. And we were in different bands back then, and we saw each other play. And we just started hooking up with each other because we felt like that guy's the best in town. And then maybe they thought I was the best in town. So we got, let's start a band. And we started Force, but we didn't stop there. We went to shows together. We went to see Thin Lizzy when they came to town, Rainbow, Deep Purple when they came back with The Perfect Strange. We were there in fifth row with our fists up. You know,
And we studied those guys. And David Coveted will say it to me now. You've stole my microphone, Booze. Yeah, I have. And he knows it. You know, we studied and we have that in common. So we went home after these shows, had a drink and just dream and listen to albums and together. So I think that still we can talk about those things after the shows today. So I think that has something to do with it. Also, the love of the same music, like you say, we like some of the same music too, and that helps. But I don't know; it's hard to say. They're great people as well. Some they like being in the band. That's a secret as well. Some people have a hard time going on tour, being amongst the same people, and compromise all the time. It's people are different, but these guys tend to the biggest cause here is the name Europe, and we go forward and we keep it together. And when someone says let's go on tour and go in the studio, we do it. So it's a personalities as well, Eddie, and we're lucky that everybody seemed to think the same way.
Well, then that's just it, because a band is just not a musical partnership, but you spend so much time in close quarters with each other, and you've got to be able to click and be able to coexist in that way too. And we both know that there are so many acts out there, and I know many of them, where the guys in the band are in separate quarters and won't even stay in the same hotel in the same city when they're on tour. So there's a lot of that out there. So you've got to, but I would imagine it's such a better working situation when you can connect with bandmates for decades on a personal level and a friendship level, as well as a musical level. That would really be the ultimate situation. It sounds like that's been the case for Europe.
Yes, it has. And now, if we have an argument now, we try to head it on and talk about it, because that's also a problem. A younger band could be a small thing even, Eddie, and then that becomes huge because you have the ego and you're younger and it just blows out of proportion. And one guy just takes off. And then it's gone too far and you can't bring it back. But now, if something would happen now between me and John or anybody else, we would like, let's talk about this now, because we don't want this to become a thing. So you learn as well. And that comes with feeling appreciative of the situation and feeling lucky that we have this job. So we don't want to rock the boat now. It's too late for that.
Yeah. No doubt. You know, John, Joey, I'm curious, when you were coming up in Sweden, you mentioned a couple bands that I love and many others do in Purple and Lizzie. But the thing with those bands, which I always try to tell my audience here in the U.S. and Canada, where I broadcast to, is that those bands, like here in America, those two bands are looked at for one song or maybe two songs. They don't hold nearly the same stature that they do in Europe and other parts of the world. And I've said that this to my audience so many times. If you talk to people who are from Europe, they will tell you what a band like Deep Purple or Thin Lizzy means to them. It's way more than The Boys Are Back in Town and Smoke on the Water. Can you talk a little bit about that from your perspective growing up in Sweden, what those bands mean to people and to rock fans in that part of the world?
Sure. So Deep Purple, it's probably for us, they almost did the Blueprint album with Made in Japan. So we were, having a party. The parents were away. We were young teenagers, and we listened to Made in Japan, and we listened to the expression and the musicianship and how they played, and it was so great because they were so young actually on that album as well, and so we felt like, wow, they're so young, they can do this, we can do this. But Deep Purple also, they had different styles in their music. It was a bit of jazz, it was a bit of soul, it was a bit of rock and roll. And they never listened to anybody. They just, albums were different. They moved in different ways, but they also picked great musicians. I mean, Richie Blackmore is just a legend, and the singer, Ian Gillan, and Ian Paice. When Ian Paice, we tend to follow the musicians as well. So we knew Ian Paice. So then we went to see Gary Moore with Ian Paice. And then we're like, you follow Ian Paice through other acts, and you realize there's a connection. Thin Lizzy, I don't know, they were just amazing with their guitars and the melodies and the lyrics from Phil Lynott. And when we saw them play, Phil was so great with the audience, and we felt like we were his friend, and it felt like we belong in this concert hall. And the music, there's so many more songs than Boys Back in Town. I mean, that is great, but there's Bad Reputation, for instance, and there's so many examples. But we saw them year after year after year, and maybe that is something, because Thin Lizzy did not tour a lot in the States at all. I think they did one or two, and they cut one short, I think, one tour. And
yeah,
I think that has something to do with it. I mean, you probably know, you probably have your own take on this. You've written books about it and stuff. I mean, it could be the fact that they didn't go over there so much. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, and I've talked to Scott Gorham about it, and he's a friend, and he's been on the show a lot of times, and he feels like there was this one tour where they were just about to break, and it might have been around the time of Jailbreak, and he said that he felt that Phil had. Well, we all know that Phil had his demons and his issues, yeah, and he had gotten hepatitis, and he was hospitalized, and he couldn't travel. And Scott has always said to me that he felt like that was a really pivotal point, because they were just on the cusp of getting ready to break. And then when they had to cancel that tour and didn't come over, he felt like that was really something they never quite recovered from.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, like we said, Thin Lizzy, they had Rosalie as well, which was more like a rock song, more like an American song. There was different elements to them, and I think Phil liked ZZ Top. I think he liked that band a lot. So there was connections. But I have to add, though, that Thin Lizzy was also this band that had those melodies almost back to classical or kind of melancholic old melody things in the music, whereas I see America as a young rock and roll country. It may have been something there too, but I have to say Thin Lizzy is one of my favorite bands ever, and it was John Norum. We used to sit, his stepdad had a record collection that was so big, so when I met John Norum, we used to go to his place. His stepdad worked at Sony and CBS, it was in those days. And he played me, you know, Journey, the UFO, Thin Lizzy. I've heard them a bit, but John was like, listen, you got to listen to this, man. This is amazing. And, you know, if we start a band, it's got to be like this. And that sort of got me into writing more songs like that. So John inspired me to write like that. He didn't write so much. He was just mesmerizing me with his guitar playing. I mean, to hear John Norum and Yngwie Malmsteen was the two guys around. And there was a tape of Yngwie Malmsteen floating around, his first demo tape, and we listened to that. It's like, wow, this is amazing. He even called me one time, Yngwie, and said, hey, maybe we should work together. But then I had John, and John was just, he had that little blues element, little feel element in his playing that differentiated him from Yngwie a little bit. So, and John and me were like brothers, but anyway, we listened a lot to Thin Lizzy, and there's so many songs that are amazing. I mean, that's great craft.
I'm just curious, Joey, being from Sweden and growing up in Sweden, you still live in London now? Are you in London now still?
Yeah, but, I've been in London for, oh my goodness, a long, long, long time. I lived abroad longer than I lived in Sweden, but I have my family there. My mom's still alive. She's there. My brother and the band is in Stockholm. So we rehearse and record there quite a lot.
I'm curious what the scene was like for Europe as coming up as a band trying to make it. What was the scene like in Sweden? And also, you mentioned Yngwie being from there. Did you see him before he came to America? Did you see him playing? Like, was he on the club circuit as a really young kid? Did you cross paths with him much?
Yeah, we did. John Levin, the bass player of Europe, and John Norum, they knew him better than me, but I met him as well. I went down to his rehearsal place. He was sitting in this dungeon cellar practicing 12 hours a day. We loved him, and we loved his playing. And those demos I talked about earlier, they circled around way before he went to America. And just, I think, we went partying with him, and we talked to him a lot. And we were friends. And we saw him play before all that happened. And it was quite amazing. He was clearly going to go places. But we had our thing in Upplands Väsby, our suburb. We had our thing with me and John, and it was just, we had our thing. We didn't want to disturb that. So we went our own path. But I remember talking to Yngwie, and he said he was going to go over, and he got a deal in America. And I said, yeah, I think he mentioned, would you like to come with me and stuff? But I had Europe, and John was my best buddy. So that was it.
Yeah. And John Norum, obviously a phenomenal guitar player in his own right,
yeah,
no doubt.
Yeah.
Joey, when was the first time that Europe played in America? When was the very first time you came over? Do you remember what the very first show was and when you came over? Was it for the Final Countdown, or did you come over previous to that?
No, we didn't come up previous, but we did some sort of convention, I think, for CBS. It was quite a big deal. Everybody was there. Yetnikoff, Mottola, everybody was there. And I remember doing that for, I think that would have been the first. And then we came over for the Final Countdown tour. I think we may have started in San Francisco or around that area. I remember meeting Vince Neil and the guys. Yeah, the guys from Motley Crue came to the show. Guys from Night Ranger came to the show.
When you came over for the Final Countdown, the first time you came to America, we all know MTV was new at that time. The song was and still is huge. All of that happened. But were you headlining when you first came to America to tour?
Yeah, actually, Eddie, we did an evening with Europe. We had Herbie Herbert, Journey's management. He signed us on, and we worked with him. He arranged. We had a plane, and we flew, and we did an evening with Europe in big theaters. It was quite cool, and we had a great experience. The first tour, it was a great time to come to America. It was one of the dreams when we were kids to be a touring band like Deep Purple or anybody. I mean, Aerosmith or anything like that. These guys, they tour all the time. We'd like to do that. Coming to America was a big deal for us, and Herbert, the manager, then he had Journey, of course, and me and John Norum really loved Neil Sean and Steve Perry, and so that was all like a dream. It was great to come to America finally and have a management in San Francisco, and yeah, it was pretty cool.
So the Final Countdown comes out in America. And the song and the album and the video and MTV and all of this really drives this thing. So I imagine that was the catalyst as to why you were able to come to the U.S. for the first time and be able to make your first American tour be a headlining tour. So it was probably, you know, after all that stuff hit, were you aware, obviously, that the song connected here and connected around the world, but were you aware of this thing that we had here called MTV that was driving everything?
Yeah, I got to know it through the office, the Black Rock CBS office in New York. And they explained, because the MTV office, it wasn't that far away. They brought us over there one day. You know, they was like, check out, this is MTV. And they'd love for you to make great videos and big videos. You know, that era it was a cool thing. It was a new thing. But just to backtrack a little bit with CBS, yeah, we had some success. We were number one over in Holland, where everything usually started over here. And Final Countdown started to go up in the charts, the album and the song. And we were signed to America, but it happened in Europe first. That's the whole thing. But then America realized, hang on a second, these are our signing, and they're number one everywhere in Europe. Let's do this. And then they pushed a button at CBS, and that's, come over here, let's do this. The thing is, they started it by introducing Kevin Elson as a producer, Journey's producer, and signed me. I went to New York first time. I was 21 years old. Went up to the office to meet them all, Tommy Mottola, everybody. I was just a little kid. And we played Scream of Anger, maybe from Wings, and Stormwind, The Dreamer, Open Your Heart, those songs. And they really liked it. And they're like, oh, these guys are interesting. Because Bon Jovi has just been signed, obviously, with another label. And I think they were looking for something similar. So they signed us, but they didn't really work it. So Europe happened first. And then we came over.
Yeah. And you mentioned Bon Jovi. I don't know if you're aware of that, but when you first came on the scene, when Europe first came on the scene here in America, there were a lot of comparisons between the two bands because people said you resembled him and the way you looked and everything like that. It was that era of the videos and the certain looking, good looking front guys and all that sort of stuff. So there was a lot of comparison to that, but you guys very much overcame that, I think, because as much as I like Bon Jovi and know Bon Jovi, I always, you know, I think it was an easy comparison to maybe make visually, but if you really listen to the record, I think you guys were coming from a little bit of a different place.
Yeah, it was different, even though possibly we had, I think John likes Thin Lizzy as well. I think there were some connections there, but it was slightly different musically. We met them a few times over the years, a great guy. So, but it was more the magazines over here. They were crazy. They were pinning me and John up next to each other and stuff. It was crazy over
here. Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Did you win any of those battles, Joey?
No, it was when I met John, it was fine. Well, the first time we met was actually Top of the Pops, one of the biggest shows in the 80s in the UK. If you were number one at Top of the Pops, that was it. That was crazy big. And we were number one once. And maybe some other times, I don't remember. But we were number one with the Final Countdown. And Living on a Prayer, I think, was number seven. And they came into the studio and they were like, oh, you guys, what's going on? And that was the first time we met. But since then, we've met many times. We're all cool. And I think they've done, I mean, what would the planet be without bands like those guys, you know? Bon Jovi, definitely.
No doubt.
I mean, it's great. It's great.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, it's great that you're still going. It's great that Europe is still going. It's great that it's still the key guys, the guys we all know and love. And the thing, you know, just bringing this full circle here, the thing that I most love about what you're doing is that your recent records, some of these bands we talk about obviously didn't stand the test of time. They didn't last. There's been a ton of lineup changes. Maybe some of the members just can't do it anymore, whatever the case may be. Some of them don't even bother to make new music. In the case of Europe, as you know, I love some of your recent albums. War of Kings was a recent favorite of mine. It's just an incredible record. So you guys have really just continued to pump out some great stuff. And now I know we have this brand new song, Hold Your Head Up, which came out just a few days ago, along with a music video. So tell us about this new song. And is this going to lead to an eventual new Europe album?
Thank you, Eddie. We took a new start, didn't we, 2004, and we've done six new albums since we started again. We're touring and we're having a blast. We went into the studio about a few months ago and recorded one new song, and over the pandemic there was some extra time. I managed to get some really good ideas down, and everybody loved this idea, so we hooked up with Ghost producer Klaus Orland, and we managed to record this in between shows, and it turned out really, really good. And it's just come out. And it feels kind of fresh. And yeah, we like to stay fresh and try to be innovative and have fun with it, you know?
Well, yeah. And do you plan to make a full record, or did you just do this as a test maybe with the producer?
Yeah, no, we wanted to check out Klaus, obviously. Whether we're going to work with him or not, we're discussing. But yes, we are throwing ideas around. We have some great ideas. And yes, we will make a new album. But this was something we wanted to have out now, because we have a documentary coming out as well from the suburbs of Stockholm out to the world. We found some old VHS tapes from, I think some of it's from San Francisco as well, when we record the Final Countdown in the studio with Kevin and the hotel rooms in Japan when we were like very young and backstage from 83, 84. And we managed to put this documentary together with people like from Ghost are in it, Benny Anderson from ABBA's in it talking, and we're just honored that people wanted to take part of this documentary. It's coming out beginning of next year, and so we wanted this song to be part of that documentary. That was also part of the plan, and this 40th anniversary tour we do. Yeah, it's just we were lucky getting this song together, because it seems like it has some legs, so we're happy.
Yeah, no, so it sounds like the song is more of a catalyst or a marker for the 40th anniversary, the touring that you're doing now, and the coming documentary, and then you'll revisit what you want to do as far as a full record at some point. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. But we do have some really great songs cooking. Obviously, Hold Your Head Up will be on there as well. So yeah, we're right now in the middle of touring, and then beginning of next year we'll be in the studio again, and you know, doing some new ones.
Yeah, I'm looking at your schedule. I didn't realize, I just pulled up your site, that you're actually on tour now, and you're on a day off, and you have you're playing Germany tomorrow. You played Italy last night, right?
Yeah, that's right. But I had to take a day off to do Eddie, you know. Why not?
Well, I appreciate that, man. It means a lot. And the last thing, and then I'll let you go and get back to your evening off at this point there.
It's all right,
do you
mate.
Do, Do you plan to get over at all to the U.S. and play live shows? Would you like to do a run here? Is there some talk of that maybe for next year?
Yeah, we're looking. We're really looking. And we were actually booked 2020 when the pandemic hit. It was all set. With Foreigner in Kansas. And it was a huge tour planned, and then it all fell apart, and it didn't happen again. So we're looking to get something like that. Maybe go with some other bands and have a fun again in America. That would be great. And yes, we are looking. So let's hope something comes together.
Yeah, and I'm a huge fan of documentaries, especially music documentaries. So I can't wait to see the one on you guys. And I know the audience will look forward to that as well. I'm sure here in America, we'll be able to see it on one of the streaming platforms or something like that. Is that the plan?
Yes, absolutely. It will be available, and hopefully a lot of people can enjoy it.
Well, I'll get the word out when it is. Joey, I'll let you get back to your evening. I appreciate the time. It's always great to talk to you. And everybody check out the new song from Europe. Again, it's out now. Video as well for Hold Your Head Up. And fingers crossed we'll get some dates in the U.S. soon. Best to the guys, and safe travels, Joey.
I will. Thank you. Great talking to you, Eddie. Thank you so much.
You too. Take care.
Well, in my opinion, Europe has made some of their best new music recently, like their last 2-3 records, among the best stuff they've done, in my opinion. And, of course, there's that new single out that Joey talked about, and new album coming down the line, and a documentary on the band, which I'm very much looking forward to seeing. Of course, being a big fan of docs, I can't wait to hear and see that when that is released. Thanks to Joey Tempest for checking in. Thanks earlier to Rick Emmett for checking in. And thank you for listening to my podcast. I appreciate it. Remember, new episodes hit every Thursday. Anywhere you get your podcast, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss one. And again, everything you just heard originated live on the radio on my SiriusXM radio show, Trunk Nation. Please join me for Rock Talk and interviews each and every weekday, live 3 to 5 Eastern, noon to 2 Pacific, on Faction Talk Channel 103, or anytime on the SiriusXM app. Last week, I brought you that big Sammy Hagar special. If you have SiriusXM, you can watch that and hear the music performances by going to the SiriusXM app right now. Full video of that is now available also. Get that free trial if you don't have SiriusXM, and you can sample it for 3 months. No credit card required. Again, SiriusXM.com/Eddie Trunk. Thank you for listening. I will catch you guys again next Thursday for a new episode of the podcast, or hopefully every weekday on the radio. Take care.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie, and fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.